Thanks for that, Susanna, and thanks to the IRFA Status of Women Committee for inviting me today. So what I'm going to do today, I want to note first that there are some photos in this slide deck, and those were taken by my research associate who I traveled with this summer to all the oil producing areas in Saskatchewan. Her name is Valerie Zink, so the photos are not mine. They're all hers except for the very last photo. But what I'm going to do today is tell you a little bit most broadly about studying Saskatchewan's oil economy and suggest that there has been a missing feminist methodology and admit that I've also been remiss in leaving it out of my own work. So I was asked to talk about gender. It's not normally something that I talk about in the public or extensively. I don't structure whole talks around the topic of gender. And I haven't employed a feminist methodology, but I'll tell you a little bit more about that later. But I do think there are some gendered insights that I can make. And these have to do mostly with the masculinist workplace culture in the oil industry, family impacts and breakdown, the role of women in servicing the oil economy, the gendered impacts of the oil boom. And finally, I want to leave just by profiling some of the groups who are resisting the oil industry. That one's less related to gender, although there are some really strong land defenders, who, most of whom are women, who are involved in resisting the oil industry in Saskatchewan. So this is part of a larger project, a three-year project that's coming to its end, called What Sustains Saskatchewan's Oil Economy. And in that project, I'm asking sort of broadly, if we think about sustainability, as it's normally conceived, we think about, you know, environmental sustainability, as in things that are good for the environment. But if we think about the verb to sustain, I wanted to ask, what is it that allows for the sustaining of Saskatchewan's oil economy? Because we live in a province where we have access mostly to unconventional oil reserves, whose production is incredibly water and energy intensive, results in many impacts on the land, and all sorts of other impacts associated with Saskatchewan's oil economy. So what I wanted to do in this project was really highlight what kind of relationships, both social and natural, make an extractive economy like Saskatchewan's oil economy possible, and how can it, well, I guess my premise would be that it can't be sustained actually in the long term. But more specifically, I'm working on a book with Valerie Zink, the photographer. It's mostly a book of photographs, but I have a 10,000 word essay in it where we examine sort of how individuals and communities that are living with oil are struggling through a mix of engagement, celebration, acquiescence, and resistance to oil economy. So if you go to oil producing areas in the province, you'll see a lot of enthusiasm about the oil economy. People proudly point to brand new boats and huge mansions as evidence of what the oil economy is doing for their communities. But they're also at the same time suffering through health impacts associated with venting and flaring. Landowners are suffering through an incredible number of spills and leaks on their land. Mostly salt water is actually more dangerous than oil for them. Almost no housing availability. There's all sorts of impacts that people will talk about, but they feel, for the most part, really that they're not able to engage these, right? For fear that they are calling into question their neighbors' incomes or their community's viability. And this happens in the context, of course, of a declining rural economy across the province and the consolidation of large farms, which has meant that many communities that don't have an oil economy have suffered from depopulation and decline over the last few centuries. So it's that sort of tension between people's engagement with the industry alongside their knowledge of its impacts and their struggles with those impacts that I've been looking at. So the primary method for my research has been interviews. I've interviewed a really wide range of folks for this project, which is a little bit of a problem because my focus has been a little bit too wide, but that's okay. It was a Shirk Insight Development grant, so now I can home in on a couple key questions. But I feel like I have a really good sort of broad perspective of the industry now. So I've been interviewing landowners, which is a particular title, which, you know, those who are considered landowners would probably prefer to call themselves farmers and ranchers, but because of the surface rights legislation, they're understood as landowners. oil workers, temporary foreign workers who are servicing oil economies, municipal politicians in the booming areas of the oil economy, faith leaders, service providers, anywhere from folks who work in mental health and addictions to psychologists, etc. Regulators, although I've burnt all my bridges now with regulators, they won't ask me, or they won't answer any of my questions anymore. So it was a good thing that I started with them. and what I'll loosely call here land defenders, some of whom I'll profile at the end of the presentation. I've also done some participant observation through attending surface rights meetings and other oil industry meetings. There's an important one coming up at the end of May in Regina on the Williston Basin, looking at the back in formation that is on both sides of the American and Canadian borders. During my research trip this summer, I stayed in campgrounds. We drove a truck and pulled a trailer and stayed in campgrounds across the area. And so we also had a lot of interesting experiences talking to people in campgrounds and bars and other places as well. Okay, so just to give you a real rough, broad sense, on Monday, Robert Hackett was here. He was giving a talk on climate change and the media's underreporting of climate change. And all of his examples were from Alberta. And I think we're all really familiar now with the example of Alberta and the tar sands development, which is incredibly environmentally destructive. But I think what we often forget is that Saskatchewan, although we don't have any of those large industrial projects, we are the second largest oil producing province in the country. The industry has been here for a long time. Commercial development started in the 1950s, and that there's been a renewed boom, although perhaps now a bust in the last few months, but a renewed boom in the 2000s, starting roughly in 2006, which is a broader provincial boom, but a lot of that broader boom has to do also with an oil boom. And that oil boom has to do with the development of what we call unconventional oil resources. So a lot of shale oil, or what is more popularly known in the media as fracking, although not fracking for gas, but fracking for oil. So a lot of shale oil development, enhanced oil recovery techniques, including carbon dioxide flooding. We just have the new carbon capture project at Boundary Dam, and the carbon that's being captured there will be transported by pipeline to Cenovus's energy fields in the Weyburn area for an enhanced oil recovery process. We have technologies like steam-assisted gravity drainage that are operating in the heavy oil fields, producing what the industry actually does call bitumen. We have something which is in its experimental phases and probably now with the new oil prices won't be developed, called oil shale, which is different from shale oil. It's too bad that they share the same words in their title. I won't tell you too much about it, but it's basically immature oil that has to be retorted underground by applying intense heat before it can be produced. So all of these unconventional oil resources are what someone like Andrew Nikiforuk would call bottom of the barrel oil. In other words, they're not easily accessed. You have to apply a lot of energy to extract them, a lot of water to extract them, and of course, new technologies. Saskatchewan, just to note here, Saskatchewan has the highest greenhouse gas emissions per capita in Canada. So if we're thinking about the sustainability question as it's conventionally framed, I think one area that's particularly important in terms of the broader climate change movement is Saskatchewan's waste in its oil and gas industry. So fully 21% of the emissions in Saskatchewan come from what they call fugitive sources from the oil and gas industry. So 21% of the highest per capita greenhouse gas emitting province, 20% of those emissions come from just waste from the oil and gas industry. This isn't coming from the burning of fossil fuels for so-called productive uses. This is coming from pipeline leaks, wellhead leaks, venting and flaring of associated gases. And I'll leave it at that. This is just to give you a sense of where some of the oil fields are located. In the southeast corner of the province, we have a couple different formations. One of them, the Bakken Formation, which is known a little bit more broadly because of its or popularly because it also is being rapidly developed in the in North Dakota. But there are other formations in there that are producing light to medium oil. The oil shales, that experimental project, which is probably not going ahead now, in the Hudson Bay area, we have medium production of oil in that sort of Shaunavon area in the south, well, central west, I guess. Light and heavy oil, lighter around Kindersley, heavy oil around Lloydminster. And we do have oil sands in the north of the province. They have yet to be developed. Cenovus actually just bought the leases from Oil Sands Quest, a company that went bankrupt a couple years ago now. But I just heard that they pulled out in, not officially, but their equipment went home in January. So the low oil prices are certainly affecting the possibility, the development of the oil sands in Saskatchewan as well. Okay, so that's just a really broad, quick overview of the industry. Of course, there's way more to tell. But I wanted to move on to talking about my missing, there was a whole bunch of facts there I didn't give you about how many barrels we're producing, but I'll just skip over that for now. I wanted to move on to telling you a little bit about my missing methodology. So this is a picture of Coffee Row in Colville, Saskatchewan. It is in an area of rapid production associated with some of the with the Viking formation. There's a lot of fracking going on in this area and other production as well. And we were here one morning because one of the landowners that we were talking to the day before wanted to invite us to his group of probably average age of 60-year-old men in the morning. And this was Coffee Row. And this was largely, you know, representative of a lot of the people that we talked to, or that I talked to, I guess, I interviewed on my field trip to the oil-producing areas in Saskatchewan. So gender wasn't an object of my study. Instead, I've been mostly employing political ecology lenses to look at how access to and control over resources is structured in Saskatchewan's oil economy, and looking at what socio-natural relations support the extractive industry, as I've said. So this meant that actually I had very little, because I didn't build into my study opportunities to engage with women or even queer the question of what men and women mean. It means that I largely had very little access to women staying in campgrounds. It was mostly men. And many of the landowners who had, as they would call them, wives, were around when I was interviewing them, but not present at the table, despite that I had, you know, encouraged them to be part of the interview. So traditional family structures and roles, for the most part, exist in many of these rural areas. And because of my methodology, that's all I can present to you today, right? I didn't have access to those who are maybe living in less traditional gendered roles in their families, and I would have had to employ other methods in order to see that stuff. So that's a caveat, just to say that, you know, I've done a really poor job of the gender question. And again, I was kind of taken off guard because I'd never thought really about giving a presentation about gender per se, although I do write about it in small parts in the rest of my work as well. So just another example of some of the work that I'd be doing here. We're pouring over a map of this farmer's fields and all the oil infrastructure that's on the fields. So there's a whole bunch more I could say about that, but I think since we're already at 15 minutes, I should move on. The title of the talk was Feast or Family, and this quote, this was actually a quote that came from a rig worker that I interviewed who characterized the oil industry and the work lives of workers in the oil industry as it's either feast or family. So in other words, there's cyclical periods of boom and bust in the industry that are not just over long time scales, but actually yearly. And when, for the most part, men have access to oil work, they're doing it for long periods of time, long days with very few days off. But when things like road bans come into place, something called breakup, the period of breakup they're mostly home with their families. So general laborers can find all sorts of jobs in the many companies that contract to oil companies. They can do so often without the requirement of grade 12. These laborers can make between $30 to $35 an hour, working 12-hour shifts in various rotations, with as many as 10 to 12 days on in a row before they see a day or two of rest. And some of these folks even pick up shifts on their days off. In a good year, they can pull in around $100,000 or more. But oil work is, however, oil field work also comes with a whole lot of uncertainty. So during the spring, when municipalities impose road bans on heavy traffic in an effort to conserve grid roads, many people are without work. This period can last from 4 to 8 weeks, longer in other years. So for example, in 2011, there was a year of flooding during which there was very little work done in the oil patch throughout the whole year. In 2011, for example, rig crews logged as few as 90 days of work. So uncertainties around work are not just seasonal. Some oil workers have no set schedule at all. They don't find out until the day before at what time they work, and they don't go home until the job is done. Many workers are often on call, especially those driving trucks that vacuum up fluids or working other equipment that would be called out to deal with an unpredictable event such as a spill. So those are people who are living in oil producing communities, and then you have a whole host of workers who are traveling from other areas of the country following jobs as well, who are away from their families even more than those who are living in oil producing communities but nevertheless are away from their families for a long period of time. So these long hours and few rest days, time spent away from loved ones, is taxing on what one psychologist I spoke to called the family unit. Many oil workers were brought up and reside in those small communities that surround Saskatchewan's oil patch, and they have fairly traditional family lives that include spouses and children. So according to this psychologist, who sees many of them as patients, spouses of oil field workers are increasingly identifying as single mothers. In other words, although they have partners, their partners are away for so long that they understand themselves first and foremost as single mothers, and they structure their families in ways that where all the supports are arranged without the partner. Often in the oil industry, you can work up over a period of time to higher levels and higher positions. And sort of the coveted position is the oil field consultant. And this psychologist sort of explained that when men, for example, become oil field consultants, they have more regular working hours. And they might come home to the family, and that this is the time during which many families experience breakdown and divorce. So it's actually when men come home that this happens more than when they're away. And that's because, again, of the difficulties of reintegrating into the family since routines and social supports have been built around their absence. And the fact that men often feel unneeded and unwanted once they do come home. I'm sort of going really quickly over a whole bunch of material here just to fit it into this presentation. But another thing that really structures gendered relations in the oil field is the division between oil field and non-oil field wages. Okay, so it is true that there are very few women in the industry. It is an absolutely masculinist workplace culture. But it's also the case that there's a huge gulf between those who are servicing the oil field workers in industries like accommodation, restaurants, and bars, and those who are making oil field wages in oil towns, right? So largely it's the men who are pulling in the higher paychecks, and women who are doing a lot of the servicing work and making relatively little in terms of wages. So I'm actually good Facebook friends with Brian Zinchuk, who's the editor of Pipeline News, Saskatchewan's oil newspaper. We disagree on a lot of things but share a common interest in the oil industry. And so when I posted about this talk, he wrote back to me and said that over the 6.5 years that he's been the news editor for Pipeline News, He's seen a total of 40 women working in the oil field, and he counted them. He started counting them. The first time he encountered one, it was so momentous that he took note, and he started counting women that he'd encountered through his reporting. And he's a really active reporter. He's at all of the events, all of the industry conferences. He's out in the field interviewing employers. He's all over the place. And he says he wanted to make the caveat that these 40 women in the oil field are actually women who are working in the field, wearing coveralls and gloves and not working in some sort of geologist or engineer capacity. So he talked about the places where you do see them largely as swampers. These would be women who sit in the passenger side of a truck, like a vac truck, for example, that's going out to vacuum up fluids. Sometimes as equipment operators, sometimes as truck drivers. The one place that boosted the numbers was a particular pipeline company called Vantage Pipeline, a particular pipeline company called A and B Pipeliners who were working on the Vantage Pipeline, where he found 10 women at one worksite. So if you subtracted those 10 women at that one worksite, he's seen 30 scattered across the industry in the last 6.5 years. So women are overrepresented in jobs that service the oil patch and its workers. Also temporary foreign workers. I did do some interviews with temporary foreign workers here, but I won't talk about them today. The discrepancy, again, between oil field wages and other work is significant. So one effect of this pay gap is that public and nonprofit sectors have a really hard time attracting and retaining workers. And this was certainly the case for the Interval home that I interviewed, or whose AGM I went to in the Lloydminster area. There was a lot of talk about retaining workers for this field because, of course, they're not being paid very much. And if they have spouses that are working in the oil industry, often they've been incentivized to stay home and take care of children if they have any. The services provided by these sectors are actually, though, increasingly in demand. So according to one psychologist in the Southwest, the relatively low wages and non-oil field work has motivated women with partners in the oil field to exit the labor market in order to take care of children. The long and unusual hours of the oil field combined with the high cost of childcare at a going rate of around $800 per child per month has meant that women provide a lot of their own childcare at home. And this further exacerbates the problems of retention and recruitment in public and nonprofit sectors, which are traditionally home to higher numbers of female workers. The psychologist noted just anecdotally that, especially in the age group of 24 to 30, he noticed that there are a lot of women deciding to stay home rather than seek employment outside of the work, outside of the home. So here's an exception. This is Mandy. Who was until very recently, actually until December, a swamper, one of those women riding in the passenger seat of a vac truck. And she recently obtained her Class 1 license where she graduated to the driver's seat. She admits that she hasn't seen any other women in her position. She left home at the age of 15, working at a hog barn, cleaning hotel rooms, and selling Mary Kay in whatever time remained to make ends meet. And she actually really likes the oil patch. What she likes most about the oil patch, what she likes most about the oil patch is that she no longer has to piece together multiple jobs in order to make a living. Now that doesn't mean that she doesn't have a critique of it as well, but just in her own words here, it's nice having one job. And remember, she worked at hog barns. In that list too, at another time, she was also working in a bar, which is where she actually met her current employer. She had harassed him for quite a while too about whether there were jobs to be had, and he kept, you know, sort of sloughing her off. And finally, one day he said, "Okay, yeah, we're always hiring." And so the next day, she showed up with her resume and refused to go home. But she said, "It's nice having one job. I may work a 12-hour day. I may work a 4-hour day. It doesn't matter. I don't have to come home and get ready for the next one. I can just go to bed if I want to." So for women who do break into the industry, of course, they suffer from all sorts of harassment on the job and discrimination. But it is characteristic of that duality between oil field wages and non-oil field wages, right? So here's Steph. She works at a local oil field distribution center. She's been working there for 4 years, selling all sorts of products and services to oil field contractors. So this is like, you know, a company that has everything that the oil field needs in stock, and she sells things all day. She works with and sells to men all day long. As she puts it, she, quote, takes a lot of shit. In her sales role, she is less of an anomaly in the industry because office and sales work tends to be gendered as women's work, as it is in most other industries. On top of her regular paycheck, Steph collects bonuses and health and pension benefits. She's actually really proud that she makes a comparable annual income to some of the men working in the field. But in exchange for this stable income that supports her and her two boys, she's always on call. At any time outside of her normal working hours of 8 to 5 p.m., she could be called in. And this often happens in order to sell products to the industry when there's an emergency, so things like spills. Office and sales work, interestingly, tends to be less affected by the seasonality and the downturns of the industry, though certainly a slower oil patch would affect her bonus pay. And here's a quote from Steph. It was very intimidating to go into a job like that, the one that she now has, but I felt really comfortable because I was a waitress too before. So you're used to guys and oil patch people. So it wasn't that big of a transition, but working with all men all day and having only male customers other than Mandy, you take a lot of shit, you deal with a lot of shit. So interestingly, the sort of gendered workplace of having served oil field workers in a bar prepared her for the same type of treatment she was gonna have as a salesperson. And this is a quote from a mental health worker. I know we've had a couple of women that have been, they feel, I wouldn't use the word bullied, but the workplace has not been a very positive experience. There's been some harassment, and some of them just move on into other positions. One woman in particular actually found this position where she was working with other women in the oil field, and that worked really well. So moving along, because I'm getting close to, I think you told me to only speak for half an hour, so. Moving along to gendered impacts, one of the most severe comes along with the lack of housing. So the housing boom in the rural areas, or like in Regina and Saskatoon, there's been a housing boom in the rural areas. Extremely low vacancy rates and strained social services. So in the summer of 2014, the average rental price for a two-bedroom apartment in the city of Estevan, which is in the heart of southeast Saskatchewan's oil patch, was $1,275 per month, more than the average price for similar accommodation in Canada's top three metropolitan cities, Vancouver, Calgary, and Toronto. And this causes all sorts of really severe problems for folks who are living in these rural areas. Interviews with people who are working with spousal abuse revealed that women often stay in unsafe relationships because of having access to housing through those relationships and fearing being housing insecure if they were to leave. And a nonprofit that I spoke with who works in the area of spousal abuse talked about losing a deal with a local hotel to reserve one room permanently as a temporary emergency shelter, because there is no women's shelter in this community. And they lost that deal because, again, hotels have been so full, and oil companies will rent out regardless of how many people are in that hotel room or on that floor in any given night. They'll rent out a whole floor, which makes it makes individual rooms really difficult to come by. So this worker, again, in a nonprofit working on spousal abuse, said Moose Jaw is probably the only community that we've had a little bit of movement in. But the housing list is still 3 to 6 months. So you're saying to people, you need to stay with him. Whereas before, we always used to have people call us and say, we've got an extra room if you ever have a woman leaving. These were hotels. Within a week, within probably 24 hours, we found them a place to live. Now it's not even an option. It's almost gotten to the point that we don't even look because there is no place. So just one particular example, but there are many. This is just a photo of a new housing development in the Lloydminster area. This is a photo of a really interesting motel. This was a farmer just west of Estevan who decided to put a series of retrofitted sea cans, shipping containers, in his barley field, and now operates a little hotel in his field. And he only charges $900 a month for rent there. And so I visited there and talked with a whole bunch of the residents there who had some really terrible housing experiences in the city of Estevan, and were largely workers who were coming from other areas of Canada. Okay, and then just to quickly wrap up here, this is maybe less squarely relevant, but I wanted to end on this note because I think it's important to think about what resisting the oil industry might look like. There's no organized movement against oil extraction in Saskatchewan. So unlike in Alberta, where there's a public debate, there's social movement activity working on shutting down the tar sands, et cetera, there's no organized movement against oil extraction in Saskatchewan. Even individual flashpoints of resistance are really difficult to identify. Yet, there are some serious impacts associated. There are some serious impacts associated with oil extraction in the province as well. And in a different talk, I could go through some of the more environmental ones as well. In oil-dependent communities, criticism of the oil industry can translate into social isolation, as those who speak too loudly are often deemed threatening to rural livelihoods. Where oil economies are understood as the last best hope for survival, the costs of speaking out are substantial. So for these reasons, even the most small-scale eruptions of resistance, I think, are significant and warrant some attention. This is a photo we took over Onion Lake Cree Nation. We went up in a little Cessna, we wanted to fly over the reserve. These are lands that the reserve required through the treaty land entitlement process. And they have become a really significant, Onion Lake Cree Nation has become a really significant oil producing reserve in the province. It's the largest oil producing reserve. It was really remarkable to see the development, which is way more dense on Onion Lake than it is in the surrounding areas. But while we were there, Onion Lake is 50 kilometers north of Lloydminster, for those who don't know. I have a whole bunch of details on the size of their industry, but I'll skip over that for a second. While we were there, we had a chance to speak to some elders who spoke about the lack of animals that are in the populating the areas where the oil wells are now located. And those lands, those TLE lands, used to be areas that were used for hunting and gathering of medicines and berries. And they say that you can scarcely find an animal track now in those lands just north of Onion Lake. These elders likened oil to blood. They said that that oil is to the earth like blood is to the body. It shouldn't be sucked dry. And when we left Onion Lake, we encountered this woman, Charmaine Stick, who was all alone on the corner of the main intersection in Onion Lake. And I looked out the window and I thought, oh, she looks like she's protesting. And so when the guy that we were with who was showing us the oil development disappeared, we went back and talked to her. And we discovered that she was on day 3 of a hunger strike. She was protesting recent banned elections. And when I talked to her in more detail, she said, well, we're protesting recent banned elections, but really what I am interested in is the fact that there's been all of this oil development and yet many people in the community are still living in substandard housing. So she was really protesting the distribution of oil revenues in her community. We talked to her for a while and asked her whether she wanted to be put in touch with media contacts, and she did, and so we used our sway to get a little article about her written in the Star Phoenix after that day. So that's a really individual example, but we've been in touch with her since then, and she's been very much affected by that protest in terms of having access for her and her children to things like jobs and housing on the reserve, because if you're seen to be anti-development, you're seen to be anti, and the reserve and the band council is pro-development, you can come across some problems in that way. We also visited Thunderchild First Nation, which is home to this woman, Marilyn Wappas. We visited, she invited us to the end of the Sundance that year, partly because she wanted us to see the traditional Sundance grounds that had been desecrated the year before from seismic testing for oil drilling on her land. So she led a protest in 2013. It was led by Marilyn Wappas and a small number of women, and supported by some of the band members on the reserve. And the ceremonial Sundance grounds, they vowed to defend from seismic testing, which had already been underway. Band officials sought and won a court injunction, which forced these land defenders to leave. But their 21-day protest has, at least until now, stopped oil drilling on the sacred site. So according to Marilyn, the Sundance is the most significant ceremony for many Indigenous cultures, and the grounds themselves are exceedingly sacred, in part because they host the lodges and prayer cloths of previous years. And of course, until the mid-1900s, the federal government prevented Indigenous peoples from engaging in Sundance ceremonies. And so the Sundance is also bound up in these relations of colonial domination and resistance. When the seismic crews came, we weren't allowed to take pictures of this, of course, because it was sacred, but there were lodges set up with really colorful cloths that represented prayers. And they keep these up long after the Sundance. It's prohibited to take them down, right? So you have years and years of prayer cloths hanging in the trees and in the lodges. You also can't take the lodges down. And when the seismic crews showed up, they actually tore some of these cloths down and desecrated the site. I have more to say about that, but I gotta move on. And finally, I just wanted to give this pitch, which is this is not Valerie's photograph, the one that's not Valerie's photograph. This is the Northern Trappers Alliance. They are another example of resistance to oil extraction, which is ongoing on the highway that leads to Cenovus Energy's oil sands leases north of La Loche. On November 22, 2014, this group of Dene trappers set up a checkpoint on Highway 955 with the explicit purpose of keeping both the uranium and the oil and gas industries from further damaging trap lines, animals, and the environment. So although the blockade was dismantled by the RCMP on December 1st, after the province sought and won an injunction, the Northern Trappers Alliance have maintained a camp and an information picket at the roadside, and they continue to demand that industry leave the area. And it's still there. They weathered the whole winter. So that's one sort of ongoing example. It is also wrapped up with mostly a focus on the uranium industry, but they're really resolute against having the oil sands developed as well. So I'll leave it there, and there's a few minutes for questions. I hope I didn't talk too long. Okay.
I would like to start with one question in terms of your agenda in this research.
It was a tremendous benefit to me to be a young, well, perceived as, at least, a young straight woman. The kind of, like, when you're, and also in really uncomfortable ways. Right? But when you're in a campground that's full of men, people want to talk to you about oil all the time. So you have to be careful about, you know, ethics and things like that, right? And making sure that they know what it is that you're there for, et cetera. It's funny because when I would interview regulators, I think even though I would Most often I would interview them, or sorry, email them beforehand, and so they would see my sign-off, which says, Emily Eaton, PhD, Department of Geography, whatever, right? But when we would be rolling through town, I would phone them up to put a little bit more pressure on to see if I could get the interview. And a number of regulators allowed me to interview them, I think thinking that, or imagining that I was a student, and were really shocked about the things that I knew about the industry. Just the seriousness with which I took the issues, right? But yeah, I mean, every aspect of the collection of data was gendered as well. The kind of access that I had as a woman was really troubling, but also really beneficial in certain ways to the research. Yeah. Now, okay, see, this would be a place where if I were using a feminist methodology, I would want to uncover that, right? But, I mean, it wasn't something that I probed in a lot of detail. The way to cope with it for most people is just to accept that that's the way it is, and to be, you know, to submit to continually being sexualized on an ongoing basis. I'm sure that if I went in looking for acts of resistance, I could find them, but those weren't like immediately apparent to me in my interviews, so I can't really answer that. I mean, the other thing is that they commented on just the shitty nature of relationships between women in their communities too, because being one of the only women, for example, who is involved in a particular workplace, they felt that they were suspects of suspicion by other women in their community. I don't know who's first. Samira?
So, 3 weeks earlier, I was reading a research article on how bad it seems to support being a combiner and to do research. This year, I learned this to be using this research to protest against the following section.
Well, actually, I hosted a workshop last weekend in Saskatoon that brought together some of these people who you've seen in the slides here, but people who I'll loosely call Indigenous land defenders, ranchers and farmers, environmental organizations, people who are it was meant for people experiencing the effects of extraction firsthand, and their allies. And it was actually pretty amazing to see. There's actually a strong appetite for collaborations between Indigenous people and settlers, and especially the ranchers and farmers, which you wouldn't think there would necessarily be much overlap for, but they are starting to understand themselves as, you know, having a common purpose of stewarding the land. And yeah, I mean, another presentation, I could give you a whole lot of detail about the environmentally destructive nature of the industry, and especially in Saskatchewan. The regulations here are lax, but more than that, there's almost zero monitoring of what's going on in the field. So a whole bunch of risky projects in Alberta have come to Saskatchewan in order to operate because the regulatory environment is so much more friendly here. So I think, you know, we really have... I have a lot to say about the environmental impacts of the industry here, which is much more distributed across a vast geography and therefore outside of people's normal imagination and outside of sight. But it's certainly, I mean, just the one figure of how much of our greenhouse gas emissions come just from the waste of the industry is appalling. Right? In North Dakota now, you can't really vent and flare, you have to at least conserve the associated gas. There are things like that that, like, at the very bare minimum we should be doing, and we're not. Yeah?
So, you said kind of that you also didn't deploy a feminist methodology, and then currently, when people are that they would like to send in and kind of move on to what might be an extension of the project, the community talk a little bit about the new feminist methodology, what that might look like, and if that's what you're thinking about doing in the next project, what does the next project look like?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what the next project looks like. But, I mean, there's, as you know, Michelle, a whole bunch of different traditions in feminist methodology. One just most basic thing is that I didn't put women at the center, or I didn't put gender, sorry, not women, but I didn't put gender at the center of the questions that I was asking, right? So some of the things that Sylvain was suggesting about, like, how do women cope in a harassing environment is just something that I wasn't able to look at. But there is a rich tradition, for example, in feminist political ecology. I've often thought about that, you know, bringing in some more feminist methods and focus through something that I'm already looking at, right, sort of political ecology. So how do, I mean, I come much more from the sort of political economy side of things, right? So I'm interested in, like, who benefits and how and under what conditions and those types of things. That would be really easy to incorporate a gendered analysis into. But in order to get at, you know, presumably, for example, there are non-traditional family structures as well in these areas, but I simply couldn't see them because I wasn't using the kind of methodology through which you'd be able to, you know, find those people and queer those ideas of what man and woman mean, for example. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
At all?
Not really. I have to write first. Well, this psychologist was speaking mostly from treating the spouses of oil workers. But there's, yeah, I mean, there are programs. One of the major problems in the oil industry is that people are working such long hours that, like, so for example, one of the women that I interviewed from the spousal support or spousal abuse services said that they'd been trying to get together a men's group for a long period of time, but people get off work at like 9 or 10 or whatever at night, and they can't manage to figure out how to make that schedule work with some regular meeting, of which would be convened by people paid by the public sector, don't tend to work at 9 or 10 at night, et cetera, right? So there are some programs, there are some groups that are working at trying to get programs partner with oil industry, partner with companies in the oil industry in order to get some things like information about mental health, addictions, and spousal abuse integrated into the workplace in some ways, but it hasn't been very successful so far. I asked a police chief about that, thinking that, because some of the things that we've heard about North Dakota include quite a lot of higher rates of sex work, but also abuse of sex work, of abuse of sex workers and assault of sex workers. And the chief of police didn't want to admit it. He said, oh yeah, we've seen a little bit higher rate of spousal abuse. But we're not at all worried about sex work. And what's that, Michelle? Yeah. But from what I can see, which again, I haven't gone out with these questions at the center of what I'm looking at, right? But from what I can see, a lot of it is organized around online services. So there's not, like, in many of these communities, you know, there's not a lot of street work happening. But there was even an article in the Leader Post sometime in the last year that talked about one sex worker who was moving to the Estevan area for a couple weeks, doing some business and then moving on, right? So I think a lot of it, I mean, you are talking about fairly, like, Estevan would be one of the biggest communities that I was in. You are talking about fairly small communities where the organization of kind of sex work would happen probably more easily through sort of online mechanisms. People are concerned about, I should say service providers are concerned about, there's not a lot of evidence, or at least they didn't tell me, but service providers are concerned about the man camps. We have very few man camps in Saskatchewan compared to, for example, Alberta or even North Dakota. But there are a few around, and people are really concerned about girls skipping school and hanging around the man camps. So, I mean, that's not necessarily sex work, but it just brought up that, my memory of that conversation. Not that I saw. I think those would be frowned on in many of these communities. Yeah. Yeah.
So was there any discussion about that, especially if you get a chance to talk to people who are involved in the services and support for the workers?
Yeah, there was a lot of talk about that. I mean, the prevailing discourse is that companies, when they are doing drug testing, I'm not suggesting that, I mean, there's a whole politics around that too, but when companies are doing drug testing, workers will often use harder drugs, things like cocaine, which disappear out of your system much quicker than things like marijuana. And there is a lot of worry about, especially cocaine in the oil industry, I think being a higher priced, higher status kind of drug. But there was something else I wanted to say about that. Shoot. Say your question again.
What sort of discussions are happening on this economy?
Oh, I know, yeah. But the people that I did talk to from the mental health or from the addiction services talked about just the nature of, for example, well, the nature of the work itself being really intensive with small periods of like very few breaks, right? And being therefore disruptive, not just towards people's sort of anchoring and families, but also their anchoring in communities, but also from the perspective of workers who are non-residents, that a lot of the supports that would exist in other areas don't exist in rural Saskatchewan, and they're underserviced. And so one spoke, for example, about a worker who was on a methadone program who was unable to continue the methadone treatment while he was working in the oil patch, and therefore suffered, you know, severe setbacks in terms of addictions. But yeah, certainly there's a lot of drugs. Felipe. That's a good point. Like, I mean, a lot of these gendered relationships, exploitative relationships, existed a long time before the oil industry, right? But I think it is, like, I think the sort of, it's heightened inequalities, right? So it has heightened sort of the inequality between oil field and non-oil field wages. You know, and then certainly we have other extractive industries in the province that are horribly environmentally destructive as well. We don't, you know, so to the extent to which you want to point your finger specifically at oil is as good of a question as any, I guess. But yeah, I would say it's exacerbated existing inequalities. I'll leave it at that. That'll be almost everybody's asked a question.